8th grade United States History, April 14th through the 17th. Thursday, April 16th. History Unit, Jacksonian Democracy. Lesson 3, Wooster versus Georgia. Objective, be able to do this by the end of the lesson. Number 1, explain why Andrew Jackson disagrees with Chief Justice John Marshall following the Wooster versus Georgia case. Introduction to Lesson 3. Read through this carefully because it gives a summary of Wooster versus Georgia. Another major issue that emerged during Jackson's presidency was the federal government and state government's relationship with Native American tribes. How to handle these interactions proved tricky because the Native tribes signed various treaties with the federal government, but state governments, such as Georgia, were beginning to break those treaties. Georgia, in particular, wanted legal control over the Cherokee Nation. For the Georgia government, if the Cherokee people were going to live within the natural boundaries of Georgia, then the Cherokee should follow and be held accountable to the laws of Georgia. However, the Cherokee Nation, along with Samuel Wooster, a Christian missionary who sought to aid the Cherokee Nation, argued that the state of Georgia had no legal authority over the Cherokee Nation. The Cherokee Nation responds only to the federal government. These arguments emerged in a landmark court case known as Wooster versus Georgia. In the end, Chief Justice John Marshall agreed with Samuel Wooster and the Cherokee Nation. President Andrew Jackson and Georgia, however, disagreed immensely. When Georgia intentionally disregarded and ignored the Supreme Court decision, Jackson famously responded, "John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it." Ultimately, federal marshals are not sent to carry out the decision to avoid any political conflict, while the decision from the court still stood. The hope would be that Georgia and its people would change their mind. This did not happen. Today, you will read an overview of Andrew Jackson's Native American policies from Khan Academy. Analyze Chief Justice John Marshall's conclusion regarding the Wooster versus Georgia case, and then read through Andrew Jackson's first annual message to Congress in 1829, before the case, to show his thoughts on how to treat the natives. Plan of Attack. United States History Secondary Source, Andrew Jackson's Native American Policies from Khan Academy. B. United States History Primary Source, Andrew Jackson on Indian Removal. C. United States History Primary Source and Review Sheet, Chief Justice John Marshall's Opinion on Wooster versus Georgia. Page 16. United States History, Secondary Source, Jackson's Native American Policies from the Khan Academy, Overview. U.S. President Andrew Jackson oversaw the policy of Indian removal, which was formalized when he signed the Indian Removal Act of May 1830. The Indian Removal Act authorized a series of migrations that became known as the Trail of Tears. The policy of Indian removal was devastating to Native Americans, their cultures, and their ways of life. A history of conflict between Euro-Americans and American Indians. From the earliest days of colonial contact, relations between white European settlers and American Indians were plagued by conflict over land and its natural resources. John C. Calhoun, who served as Secretary of War under President James Monroe, was the first to design a plan for removing Native Americans to lands west of the Mississippi River, but the Georgia delegation in the House of Representatives sunk the bill. President John Quincy Adams believed the issue should be resolved peaceably, but Georgia again proved an obstacle when they blocked the implementation of voluntary removal of Native Americans from territories in the southeast of the United States. It wasn't until the presidency of Andrew Jackson that Indian removal became official U.S. policy. Andrew Jackson's Indian policies. Before becoming president, Andrew Jackson had distinguished himself as a champion of white settlers against the American Indians. In the War of 1812, Jackson had led an offensive against the Creek Nation in an attempt to clear the Mississippi Territory for white settlement. And under President James Monroe, he had participated in the First Seminole War, which devastated the Seminole tribe of Florida. By the time Jackson entered the White House, white settlers in Georgia had been complaining for some time about the continued presence of Cherokee and Creek peoples on the lands they wished to inhabit. These white settlers were emboldened by the election of Jackson in 1828 and revoked the constitution of the Cherokee Nation in Georgia, declaring that the Indians were subject to the laws of the state of Georgia. In 1830, the Cherokee Nation took the state of Georgia to the Supreme Court, arguing that it was an independent nation, and as such, was not subject to the authority of the state of Georgia. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, agreed that the Cherokee Nation was a distinct society, but not that it was a foreign nation. In Wooster v. Georgia, Chief Justice Marshall expanded on this argument, declaring that the state of Georgia had no authority over the Cherokee, which, as a sovereign nation, could only be subject to the authority of the federal government. The ruling established the nature of relations between the federal government and Indian tribes as that between sovereign nations. But President Jackson refused to enforce the ruling and pursued a policy of Indian removal. The Indian Removal Act of 1830 authorized the voluntary relocation of Native American tribes to the lands west of the Mississippi River, but was frequently abused by government officials and resulted in some forced removals. Page 17. The Trail of Tears. The Indian Removal Act was applied to the, quote, five civilized tribes, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Creek, and Seminole, so named by people of the time because they had to some degree assimilated into white European culture and society. In September 1830, Choctaws became the first tribe to sign a treaty and voluntarily relocate to the territory that would become the state of Arkansas. Seminoles refused to leave their ancestral lands in Florida, sparking the Second Seminole War in 1835. Seminole chief Osceola led the resistance, which proved costly to the United States in terms of both money and casualties. The U.S. Army ultimately emerged victorious, however, and forced remaining Seminoles out of Florida and into the area west of the Mississippi River that became known as Indian Territory. Chickasaws agreed to leave their lands in exchange for a monetary settlement of $3 million, which the United States refused to pay until almost 30 years later. The Creek had been forced to cede over 20,000 acres of their ancestral lands in the Treaty of Fort Jackson following the Battle of Horseshoe Bend in the War of 1812. The remaining Creek Indians signed over the rest of their lands after the enactment of the Indian Removal Act and relocated to Indian Territory in the Trail of Tears. As for Cherokees, a small faction had signed a treaty with the U.S. government in 1835, but that faction did not represent Cherokee leadership, who refused to leave their lands voluntarily. As a result, Cherokees were forcibly relocated to the Indian Territory west of the Mississippi River. Of the 17,000 Cherokee that were rounded up, at least 4,000, and possibly as many as 8,000, perished. You can see the map of the Cherokee Trail of Tears land route at the bottom of page 17. Turn to page 18. United States History Primary Source. President Andrew Jackson on Indian Removal, 1829. During his first annual message as president to Congress, President Andrew Jackson recognized the struggles that states and Native Americans face and the possibility of Natives creating their own sovereign tribes within the borders of states. President Jackson gives his response as President of the United States, yet he also shows a sense of compassion towards the Natives. Source: Major Problems in the Early Republic, pages 374 to 376. Number 1. The condition and ulterior destiny of the Indian tribes within the limits of some of our states have become objects of much interest and importance. It has long been the policy of government to introduce among them the arts of civilization, in the hope of gradually reclaiming them from a wandering life. This policy has, however, been coupled with another wholly incompatible with its success. Professing a desire to civilize and settle them, we have at the same time lost no opportunity to purchase their lands and thrust them farther into the wilderness. A portion, however, of southern tribes, having mingled much with the whites and made some progress in the arts of civilized life, have lately attempted to construct an independent government within limits of Georgia and Alabama. These states, claiming to be the only sovereigns within their territories, extended their laws over the Indians, which induced the latter to call upon the United States for protection. Number 2. Under these circumstances, the question presented was whether the general government had a right to sustain those people in their pretensions. The Constitution declares that no new state shall be formed within the jurisdiction of any other state without the consent of the state's legislature. If the general government is not permitted to tolerate the creation of a Confederate state within the territory of one of the members of this union against her consent, much less could it allow foreign and independent government to establish itself there. Georgia became a member of the Confederacy, which eventuated into our federal union as a sovereign state, always asserting her claim to certain limits, which, having been originally defined in her colonial charter, Alabama was admitted into the union in the same footing with the original states, with boundaries which were prescribed by Congress. Number 3. Actuated by this view of the subject, I informed the Indians inhabiting parts of Georgia and Alabama that their attempt to establish an independent government would not be countenanced or acknowledged by the executive of the United States, and advised them to emigrate or move beyond the Mississippi or submit to the laws of those states. Page 19, number 4. Yet our conduct toward these people is deeply interesting to our national character. Their present condition, contrasted with what they once were, makes a most powerful appeal to our sympathies. By persuasion and force, they have been made to retire from river to river and from mountain to mountain, until some of the tribe have become extinct. Surrounded by the whites with their arts of civilization, which by destroying the resources of the savage doom him to weakness and to decay, that this fate surely awaits them if they remain within the limits of the states does not admit of a doubt. Humanity and a national honor demand that every effort should be made to avert so great a calamity. It is too late to inquire whether it was just in the United States to include them and their territory within the bounds of new states, whose limits they could control. That step cannot be retraced. A state cannot be dismembered by Congress or restricted in the exercises of her constitutional power. But the people of those states and of every state, actuated by feelings of justice and regard for our national honor, submit to you the interesting questions whether something cannot be done, consistently with the rights of the states, to preserve this much injured race. Number 5. As a means of effecting this end, I suggest for your consideration the propriety of setting apart an ample district west of Mississippi, and without the limits of any states or territory now formed, to be guaranteed to the Indian tribes as long as they shall occupy it, each tribe having a distinct control over the portion designated for its use. There may be secured, in the enjoyment of governments of their own choice, subject to no other control from the United States than as such as may be necessary to preserve peace on the frontier and between the several tribes. Number 6. This emigration should be voluntary, for it would be as cruel as unjust to compel the aborigines to abandon the graves of their fathers and seek a home in a distant land. But they should be distinctly informed that if they remain within the limits of the states, they must be subject to the states' laws. Submitting to the laws of the states, and receiving, like other citizens, protection in their persons and property, they will ere long be merged in the mass of our population. This concludes the material for Thursday, April 16th.